You see, right here on VOA Africa.
Today is Thursday, December 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Okwo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warns Russia against escalating actions towards Ukraine as he meets with NATO allies.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined other NATO foreign ministers for a long-planned meeting in Riga, Latvia.
The White House mulls new travel restrictions and tightening of testing windows amid Omicron variant fears.
First of all, we did learn that it has made landfall in the United States. There has been one case reported in California.
And India farmers make fresh demands to the government after repeal of controversial farm laws. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has again warned Russia of, quote, serious consequences, unquote, for any escalating actions towards Ukraine as he meets with NATO allies during a trip to Latvia and Sweden. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined other NATO foreign ministers for a long-planned meeting in Riga, Latvia, at a time of heightened concern about Russia massing tens of thousands of troops and heavy armor close to its border with Ukraine. Blinken said the U.S. has seen Moscow's playbook many times before, pointing to Russia's seizure of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Any escalatory actions by Russia would be of great concern to the United States, as they would to Latvia. And any renewed aggression would trigger serious consequences.
For his part, Russian President Vladimir Putin brushed off Western concerns, saying there was no invasion when he amassed troops at the border earlier this year. Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Look, they talked about the possible introduction of Russian troops into Ukraine at the beginning of the year. But as you can see, this did not happen.
But as NATO foreign ministers held meetings behind closed doors to calibrate a response to Russia, Michael Kimmage of the German Marshall Fund said diplomacy was crucial at this volatile moment to avoid more bloodshed. Michael Kimmage is with the German Marshall Fund and with Catholic University.
What we're talking about, potentially, is a major war on European soil, something that has not happened since 1945. This would be different from Yugoslavia because of the constellation of countries that's there in the region. I think it's very possible, if there's real war between Ukraine and Russia, that Poland, Lithuania, Baltic republics might feel it necessary to enter the war on the side of Ukraine.
President Joe Biden is set to hold remote talks with Putin in December. Judy Dempsey of Carnegie Europe said she believes high-level diplomacy holds more promise than sanctions. Judy Dempsey is with Carnegie Europe. She spoke to VOA.
We have to have some serious dialogue between Washington and Moscow. We can't afford a war. It would be terrible for the people in Ukraine. And I'm not so sure the Russian public want to buy into this either, if you look at the opinion polls.
Dempsey told VOA that Putin often uses manufactured foreign policy clashes to distract from domestic problems, such as controlling the COVID-19 virus and high death rates in Russia. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says that Moscow will seek Western guarantees that would preclude any further NATO expansion and the deployment of its weapons near Russia's borders. Putin's statement Wednesday came amid Ukrainian and Western worries about Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russian diplomats have countered by expressing concern about Ukraine's military buildup near the area of the separatist conflict in the eastern part of the country. Putin emphasized Russia will seek, quote, strong, reliable, and long-term guarantees of its security, unquote. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, noting that Putin could quickly order an invasion of Ukraine, warned that Washington stands ready to inflict heavy sanctions on Russia if it does. The border between Belarus and Poland drew global media attention after thousands of migrants tried to enter the EU, encouraged by the government of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. The root of this crisis is the dispute between Warsaw and Minsk over Poland's practice of providing refuge to Belarusian political exiles. Elizabeth Shanov narrates this report by Ricardo Makina in Warsaw.
This is the Belarusian House in Warsaw, Poland. The center has become a haven for exiled activists and the democratic opposition to Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko.
We do not expect changes for tomorrow. Nobody's under any illusions. The wave of Belarusian immigrants is currently huge.
The current crisis of migrants from Middle Eastern countries trying to cross the EU border from Belarus has its roots among the Belarusian political exiles who escaped political repression last year. They include Pavel Latushko, former Minister of Culture, who sees the Belarusian leader's decision to unleash migrants at the Polish border as an attempt to return to the international scene.
Lukashenko is using migrants to achieve two goals. First, escape from political isolation, forcing European leaders to start a dialogue with him. Second, annul the economic sanctions, or at least avoid new sanctions that were taken for their massive violations of human rights.
Analysts say the massive protests against Lukashenko in 2020 following rigged elections and the subsequent political repression by Belarusian security forces are closely connected.
For the regime in Belarus, the whole migrant crisis is a very good idea to distract the world's attention from what is happening inside the country. Because still we have a lot of repressions, we have absolutely ridiculous trials, ridiculous sentences, people are in jail.
Among the targets for retribution, the media were one of the most affected groups. Independent journalists realized they could not report freely on what was happening in the country.
More than 100 journalists are in Kiev. More than 100 are here in Warsaw, many in Vilnius. It is easier to find Belarusian journalists abroad than in Belarus.
But not all exiles in Poland are activists. In this Belarusian traditional music choir in Warsaw, we find everyone from anti-government militants to people without any political affiliation.
It's very hard. I miss my home. I want to go home. I live with a hope that maybe I can go home tomorrow. And in this hope, it is very difficult to organize my life here. You do not know if you're going to stay for a week or 2 years. It is a prison in freedom.
The hope of returning home is not lost, but chances for it wane with the passage of time and the unending uncertainty. For Ricardo Marquina in Warsaw, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
The White House is mulling new travel restrictions and tightening up testing windows as it ramps up efforts to contain the spread of the COVID Omicron variant. The U.S. is working towards requiring that all air travelers to the country be tested for COVID-19 within a day before boarding their flights, up from the current 3 days. On Wednesday, the World Health Organization warned that blanket travel bans are complicating the sharing of lab samples from South Africa that could help scientists understand the new variant. For more, I spoke with VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell.
At the White House, we learned a few things about this new Omicron variant. First of all, we did learn that it has made landfall in the United States. There has been one case reported in California, and so far that patient has mild symptoms. The patient had traveled from South Africa, reported symptoms immediately. This patient had been at least double vaccinated. I don't think it's clear whether that person had a booster or not. I don't think they have. And so far, that person seems to be doing okay. This was what we were told by Dr. Fauci this afternoon at the White House. That's the first piece. The second piece is that later, President Biden is going to lay out a complete strategy for the winter for dealing with COVID. And this is almost certainly, definitely going to address this new variant. I want to also stress a few things about this variant that we heard from Dr. Fauci this afternoon at the White House, and that is that doctors in the United States simply do not yet know how dangerous, how dire, how strong, so to speak, this variant is. They do know that there's an unusual number of mutations on the spike protein, which makes it more transmissible. They do not yet know if that makes it more deadly. And they say that they're going to need about 3 weeks to study this and to make some kind of determination.
which is why the overarching line that has come out of the White House from the president on down is that this is a cause for concern. This is not a cause for panic. And that's what we know so far.
It's almost a given that the administration would tinker with either travel rules or travel or some kind of action by the government to try to protect the American population. Will that be part of what President Biden will be discussing?
Well, let's just back up and note that the president has already restricted travel from several southern African countries where the variant was first detected. That includes Botswana, Mozambique, Lesotho, Swatini, South Africa, Zimbabwe. I believe that's most of the list. I think Malawi as well. And so that is the first step that they have taken to buy time so that the U.S. can prepare and figure out what this variant is all about and what needs to be done. So, yes, the administration has already imposed travel rules. And is it likely that more will come? Well, I don't want to preempt the president or predict the president, but we will probably learn more about that.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Footage broadcast on state-affiliated television in Ethiopia has shown Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed calling on Tigrayan forces to surrender and claiming that his enemies have been defeated. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has said his enemies have been defeated as he promised to recapture territory from rebellious Tigrayan forces.
Today, the enemy is on that mountain called Geshena. We are making the plans from here. We have finished the plan by which we will rout the enemy and capture that mountain tomorrow. The main thing is, the enemy is defeated. Our remaining task is to rout the enemy and destroy them.
The Nobel Peace Prize laureate was addressing troops on the front line of the Ethiopian conflict near Geshena in Amhara, according to state-affiliated Fana Broadcasting on Tuesday. The location could not be independently verified. Last week, Abiy said he was heading to the front line to supervise operations.
Tigrayan youths are falling like leaves. They should know that they have been defeated and surrender. Starting from today, to the defense forces, the special forces, the militia, and the people, with the understanding that they are participating in something that doesn't have a clear vision or plan, and a blind and confused journey that doesn't have a destination and cannot gain a victory.
The federal military has been battling forces loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front for over a year. Last November, Abiy claimed victory over the TPLF, but having been initially beaten back, the Tigrayan forces recaptured most of Tigray, pushed into two neighboring regions, and made threats that they would march on the capital. TPLF spokesperson Getachew Reda could not be reached for comment, but on Monday he accused Abiy of engaging in farcical war games.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. A French military spokesperson has denied an accusation that French soldiers shot into a crowd of protesters in Niger late last month. As Harry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, the deteriorating security situation in Africa's Sahel region has been accompanied by increasing protests against the French forces sent to help African governments battle the Islamist militant groups who are increasingly active in the region.
Demonstrations against the French are driven by misinformation spread online that French forces are arming groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the same groups the French were deployed to fight in the Sahel nearly a decade ago. On Friday, November 26th, a French military convoy, which was stranded in Burkina Faso for more than a week as protesters blocked its progress, passed into Niger. The next day, as had happened in Burkina Faso, Nigerian protesters blocked the convoy, demanding to know what was being transported. Nigerian authorities say two protesters were killed and 16 injured on Saturday, while eyewitnesses told the French TV station TV5 Monde that they saw French soldiers firing into the crowd. In an interview with VOA, Colonel Pascal Iani, the spokesman for the French Army Chief of Staff, was asked if the French troops had fired on protesters.
Je répète ce que je viens de dire. Les forces françaises n'ont pas tiré sur la foule.
He said, I repeat what I just said. The French forces did not shoot at the crowd, he said. French forces fired above the crowd and fired in front of the crowd, at the feet of the crowd, to stop the most violent demonstrators. Ihani said that the French troops and Nigerian military police needed to take action against the protesters, armed with stones and batons, to prevent the convoy being burned and looted. Regarding the deaths and injuries reported by the Nigerian authorities, he said, I cannot confirm or affirm these results, which were announced by the Nigerian authorities. Asked if there would be an investigation, since it was unclear what had happened, the colonel said that would be up to the authorities in Niger. He said, I think they will collect testimonies. They will recover all the videotapes or photos that were taken on this occasion, and they will try to determine exactly who is responsible. Philippe M. Fraud is an associate professor at Ottawa University and an expert on the Sahel. He says anti-French sentiment has been growing in the Sahel for years.
So many of these fault lines and much of this kind of sentiment, very sort of generic sort of anti-French sentiment, has found a much clearer expression when it comes to kind of, you know, blocking this convoy.
Fraud also points out the Nigerian president said last month that French military support is essential to state security.
The French presence is indispensable, right? That if the French were to leave their base in Gao in Mali, that there would be chaos. And so I think that this reflects some sense of the calculus of how Sahel states are looking at French intervention as something that's actually primordial in terms of assuring the security of the state.
Asked if the next French military supply convoy headed for Niger and Mali via Burkina Faso would take a different route, Colonel Ihani said officials were studying different options. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
Indian lawmakers have repealed agricultural legislation that provoked a year of nationwide protests from farmers in a move that was seen as a major reversal and rare climb down for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. The farm laws repeal bill passed the Indian parliament 10 days after Modi announced a surprise decision to withdraw the reforms. Tens of thousands of farmers kept up protests outside of the capital New Delhi and elsewhere in the past year, fear saying that the new laws will drastically shrink their incomes. Political analysts say upcoming elections in key states for Modi's ruling party are a major reason behind the surprise move to withdraw the reforms that would have given more private sector control in agriculture. For more, I spoke with reporter Anjana Pasricha, who said despite the victory, the farmers have not officially called off the strike and are demanding more concessions from the government.
I don't think we can officially say that the protests are over. In fact, the farm unions are yet to take a decision on it. Of course, they're very, very happy with the repeal of the laws. They've called it a historic victory. It is a huge win for them. You know, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a leader who does not back down from his decisions and had repeatedly said there is no question of scrapping the laws. However, what the farmers say is that they still have some pending demands. They've been asking for a minimum guaranteed price for all crops. The system, which at the moment is prevalent for rice and for wheat, largely in the northern grain-growing states of Punjab and Uttar Pradesh.
What are the other demands that the farmers are asking from the government? And how likely is it that the government will give in to the fresh demands?
You know, while the focus was mainly on the farm laws, farm unions have pushed for other demands. Now, these are both big and small. The smaller demands are they want compensation for the hundreds of farmers they say died during the year-long protest, and they want the withdrawal of legal action against some farmers during the course of the protest. But the key demand is for a law that would ensure a minimum guaranteed price for all crops, the system which at the moment is prevalent for rice and wheat. They want that system for all major crops to protect them against price fluctuations. You know, the whole opposition to the farm laws was based on their fears that privatization of farm trade, which the laws had proposed would happen, would drive down prices at a time when farm incomes have been stagnant and would leave them with absolutely no bargaining power against corporates. So they want government very much at the center of all purchase of farm produce, and they want legislation for that.
It appears that the farmers are still not satisfied with what the government has done so far. But to the extent that the government has repealed some of the laws, what is the immediate benefit for the farmers?
The immediate benefit for the farmers is essentially that the government will continue with the decades-old practice of buying some crops, such as rice and wheat, at an assured price. You know, India grows a huge amount of rice and wheat. It has, I mean, absolutely bumper harvests of these two food grains. So basically, the repeal of the laws sets at rest their fears that the market reforms which had been proposed by the laws would hurt their incomes by lowering price of farm produce. They are now satisfied that the grain that they grow will be purchased by the government.
Now that it appears the government has given in to some of these farmers, some analysts are expressing fears that other sectors might borrow a leaf from the farmers and also make some demands on the government.
I think having tasted an unlikely victory, they could dig in their heels for more concessions. And also, while the protest has been largely led by farmers from North Indian states, their demand for a set price for crops has now galvanized farmers from all over the country. You know, there is distress among farmers in India, especially among those who own small plots of land. More than two-thirds of farmers own less than just about 1 hectare of land. So having demonstrated grit and determination so far, having stayed on the highways, you know, through a harsh winter, summer and a pandemic, it is likely that they could stay on for more concessions.
That's reporter Anjana Pasricha speaking with me from New Delhi. In other news, the U.S. identified its first known case of the Omicron variant Wednesday in a person in California, as scientists around the world race to establish whether the new mutant version of the coronavirus is more dangerous than the previous one. The first U.S. case is a traveler who returned from South Africa on November 22nd. The person, who was fully vaccinated, had mild symptoms that are improving. The person has agreed to remain in quarantine, and all the individual's close contacts have been contacted and have tested negative. Nigeria and Saudi Arabia also reported Omicron infections Wednesday, marking the first known case in West Africa and the Persian Gulf region. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Greece is introducing steep fines for unvaccinated people aged 60 and over as infections surge, straining the Greek state's healthcare system. The decision is generating debate among civil liberties and freedom in the land that give birth to Western-style democracy. For VOA, Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis appeared visibly concerned as he announced the mandate after an urgent cabinet meeting. Mitsotakis said he could not hide that he was, in his words, personally troubled in taking the decision. But he explained he was ultimately compelled to do so in order to protect the most vulnerable, even if that means upsetting them. Under the new rules, Greeks aged over 60 will have to be vaccinated or face a fine of $113, which the country's tax authorities have been authorized to impose and collect beginning next month. As of early Wednesday, Greece had yet to record a case of the Omicron variant, but COVID-19 infections have surged to record highs, despite recent measures that include banning unvaccinated people from entering indoor restaurants, gyms, and theaters. As upsetting as the new mandate may be for some Greeks, Mitsotakis said it does not amount to punishment. The Greek leader said the decision aims to mobilize senior citizens to get the jab. He said he has no doubt that this will help save many lives. About 63% of Greece's population of 11 million are fully vaccinated, well below the EU average of about 66%. With the Omicron variant sweeping across the continent, government officials tell VOA Mitsotakis' decision was part of a last-ditch effort to avoid another national lockdown, a move that could damage the country's already weak economy. Political analyst Vasilis Hiotis explains. Hiotis says it is a message to key sectors of the Greek economy and society, from tourism to the Orthodox Church and its millions of followers, to conform to the government's call for vaccination to avert the potential of a lockdown. Austria last week became the first Western democracy to make vaccinations mandatory for all those who are eligible. Those who do not get the shot by a February deadline face fines as high as $4,000 and possible prison time. Opposition parties have criticized Greece's decision to fine violators. They say the government should have exhausted other options before threatening to fine senior citizens on meager pensions. Vaccine opponents say the move is a breach of their civil liberties. Others, including this unidentified middle-aged Athens resident, speaking on Greek television, say the new mandate was long overdue. She says this is a health crisis, and upholding democratic values does not mean that people should behave recklessly at the expense of others. She says that would be a wrong interpretation of democracy. It is unclear whether the vaccine mandate will be effective, but officials see reason for optimism. Within hours of the Greek leader's announcement of the fines, health officials said vaccination requests tripled to 6,000. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
Pope Francis will embark on a trip to Cyprus and Greece on Thursday. The principal focus of this visit is a theme that has been dear to this pope since the start of his papacy, the world's migration crisis. For the second time in 5 years, the pope will visit the island of Lesbos, which has long been dealing with migrant arrivals. Sabina Castelfranco reports for VOA from Rome.
Pope Francis's first stop on this 5-day trip is Cyprus, which has in recent years seen an increase in migrant arrivals. The plight of migrants and refugees has been a major concern of the pope since his election in 2013, and he plans to meet with them on this trip. The pope will also be visiting the island of Lesbos in Greece, which has also been dealing with an influx of migrant arrivals. The pope's first visit after being picked to head the Catholic Church was to the small southern Italian island of Lampedusa near Africa, which has borne the brunt of migrant arrivals for decades. At the time, Pope Francis gave a strong message during a mass for migrants on the island, condemning the global indifference to their plight. The pope has visited Lesbos before, in April 2016, when it was home to the largest refugee camp on the European continent. On that occasion, he brought home with him 12 Muslim refugees from Syria. This time he will be repeating that gesture and has already arranged for about 50 migrants to be relocated to Italy after this visit. Pope Francis has often called for a reawakening of consciences, drawing attention to the condition of migrants and the need for the nations to be more responsible and united in assisting migrants. At the same time, he has called for efforts to discourage them from undertaking dangerous sea crossings. Speaking in a video message before this trip, Pope Francis spoke of all the migrants who have lost their lives at sea. On Wednesday, he referred to the migrants as our brothers and sisters and said the Mediterranean Sea, in his words, our Mediterranean Sea, has become a huge cemetery. Penso anche a coloro che in questi anni e oggi ancora. The Pope's thoughts went to those who in recent years and still today, he said, have been fleeing war and poverty, landing on the shores of the European continent or elsewhere, and who did not find hospitality, but instead hostility and even exploitation. Pope Francis considers the current migration the biggest humanitarian catastrophe since the Second World War. He has said the only way forward to combat this phenomenon is through fraternity and integration. The Pope will have other emphatic messages on this, his 35th international journey, as he addresses the majority Greek Orthodox population, along with the minority of 30,000 Catholics who also live on the island of Cyprus. He is expected to speak about the need for people to be open to one another and foster understanding. In meetings with officials in Cyprus, he is also expected to address the long-running conflict between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. Pope Francis is scheduled to celebrate a mass on Friday in Nicosia and hold an ecumenical prayer with migrants near the so-called Green Line that separates the last physically divided capital in the world. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of war events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Akua in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.